Hello and welcome to another SPAC Insider podcast, where we bring an independent eye in interviewing the targets of SPAC transactions and their SPAC partners. Not all SPAC officers get involved in order to ride that process all the way to a seat as CEO of the combined company. But James Winters walks us through his journey of how he started Nubia Brand International Corp as a newcomer to the asset class and why he is now leading its target company, Solidion. I'm Nick Clayton, and this week we'll speak with James about the changing set of options SPACs have at their disposal to raise funding and find a deal that the market can appreciate in the current climate, and how Solidion has the potential to bring greener, U.S.-based materials to the EV battery space after its SPAC-led spinoff from the Global Graphene Group. Take a listen. So just from the start, James, you've taken the somewhat unorthodox step in this deal of transitioning from the CEO and chairman of the SPAC to CEO of the combined company post-close. Taking over the company as an operator did not appear to be Nubia Brand's plan A, so to speak. So at what point did that option come to the forefront and appear more attractive to you as you were going through this process?
Well, I'm not sure that it felt more attractive. It just felt more necessary. A lot of these de-SPACs, just from our observations of myself and Vlad Prancevich, the executive vice president, chief financial officer, who's also on the newly merged company, we have observed several instances where somebody de-SPACs and they turn the keys over to people who've never, don't know what the Super 8K is, the 10Q, the 10K, all these various SEC forms, which we've had 3 years of experience doing it because we did the entire SPAC ourselves. We just felt like it's in the best interest of our shareholders and their shareholders if somebody with public company experience, and that would be us. And then myself, who already has experience as a CEO of large private companies, stayed on. We think we closed on the second. I mean, it's a pretty heavy lift. I mean, for somebody that's not used to the workload and the amount of regulatory terminology, the nuances of the stock market, the trading, people's trading strategies, what's a prop desk, what's HFT, what is a round trip, all these things that we already knew we're bringing to the table. So we said, this is what we think is going to happen, post-DSPAC historically. You do see the prices start to retrace quite a bit post de-SPAC, and we understood the reasons why. And then also just the ability to work with Wall Street. We have quite a good size investor network from where I'm sitting, and even those who are not current investors or could be construed as prospective investors. At least we have their phone numbers and we can pick them up and call them and say, hey, this is what we're looking at. If you don't know somebody, then if you don't want to do it, if you know somebody, then let us know. So that's the advantage that the management team is bringing in, is the survival as a public company. It's not very, very easy task for somebody who's ran a very small private company to all of a sudden be on NASDAQ Global without adding 20 people.
Yeah, that's really interesting. And frequently, honestly, we hear similar stories from companies that even go through regular way IPOs, where, especially in the case where the CEO has been sort of the founder of the company since the startup stage and is now suddenly a public company CEO. And oftentimes, even in a regular way IPO, they'll say that, all the banks and the advisors were with us right up to the IPO. And then it was like, all right, you're in the pool. It's like, and they're all gone suddenly. And it is one of those things that I think doesn't get talked about enough as one of the potential advantages in a SPAC transaction is just the ability that it's not just an infusion of capital and a listing. It is a partnership with a team and a team that can bring its own experience over the longer haul for a company. In this case, it was, a bit of a spinoff as well. I mean, I'm interested in sort of what your thoughts were and sort of even the searching process of like, this is a thing that we can bring our, expertise to and take it, a little bit further.
Yeah. First of all, this kind of take us back to the beginning when we didn't even know what a SPAC was. We were trying to come up with some ideas to advance some telecom assets that the investor group owned. There was a private equity firm said that, you guys are so sharp on finance, why don't you a SPAC kind of makes more sense for what your aspirations were. So we didn't know what one was. So Vlad and I spent almost a month reading through S1s, S4s, everything. There was a webinar on SPAC 101. I'm sure we looked at some of your documentation, and we had a, you know, wherever we could find a free subscription, we took one just so we would understand the whole process before we actually contact anybody. So we did contact almost 100 investment banks. I mean, and most of them are well-known SPAC underwriters. 98 of them either did not return our calls or said, no, thank you. Two did. I'm not going to mention the one that we passed on, but the one that we did pass on wanted a much larger SPAC than we were ready to handle. And it would have put us in a position to have to raise more sponsor promote. So we ended up going with EF Hutton. And hey, we kind of opened up a lot of doors. Like, you call so-and-so for their audit services, check them out. So-and-so for legal services, check them out. The formation of the actual entity kind of took place at that particular time. Obviously, we were raising capital. We had a pretty good adventure there, raising the capital. But once we did raise the capital, I mean, the day that Nubia began trading, I think it was T+2, and we were on the phone and sending out emails, not just to potential targets, but to sell side investment banks around the world. We looked at a defense and logistics company in Israel, a satellite company in Singapore, co-working space in Malaysia, construction companies, biotech, pharmaceuticals, nutraceuticals. You know, a lot of investment banks say, you know, that's, well, let me give you a, give you, call this guy, you know, sort of thing. And this guy might have something for you. And we went from there. We, well over 100 companies got screened for us in a year, well over 100 companies. We would be waking, you know, waiting for a call on the on one side of the ocean late at night, and then have to wake up, you know, like 2 hours later and have a call with a target on the other side of the ocean. But if you're going to do this, I mean, and really fulfill what I would call the regulatory requirements, you have to put in the work. And we set aside everything. I mean, there's a lot of SPAC, and the SPAC operation is part of a bigger investment portfolio. So they didn't cover the amount of ground that we did. But we told the people to put up the money, that we're going to comb the hair of the earth and get us a target. So they don't have anything to worry about, but we put a lot of time and effort into it. And along the way, we got a lot of understanding about, you know, a more understanding than a private company owner would have about the capital markets and the way the regulations and the listing requirements work.
Yeah, and I promise I want to get into all of the things that your combined company has ahead of you with your operations as well. But there was some interesting things that I wanted to follow up on, which is, you know, I mean, one of those things that I feel like, another thing that I feel like doesn't get discussed as much when talking about SPACs is, you mentioned the size of the raise and the size of the SPAC. You know, I mean, with, you know, average redemptions being what they are across the board, really, in the SPAC market over the last, you know, few years, there are some advantages to being smaller from the start. There's going to be less surprises. And I'm just interested in how, I guess, how much do you feel like, you know, you went through your own education curve? How much would you feel like you were having to educate targets about all the different moving parts? And if that, you know, came into play once you found the deal you ultimately did do, because it's in a space where there has been a lot of SPAC activity over the last few years.
Right. I mean, the size of the SPAC does matter. I mean, if you look at the liquidations, a lot of the liquidations were for the big ones, because, you know, if you have $500 million sitting in the trust, you know, you're not going to buy a $450 million EV enterprise value company. You're going to be looking at $2 to $3 billion. I mean, at that size, a lot of people can just go public without a SPAC and be done with it. There's not going to be a lot of takers. Although I have seen, I think, Lionsgate and some other deals come through as of late that are sizable. But at the time that we were looking, I mean, it certainly did not make a lot of sense for our expertise, because we didn't see anything that we could readily get our hands on that was smaller or bigger than like $1 billion. And if, of course, this was a cutting edge technology kind of hyper growth part of the sector of the car sector as this move towards electrification. But other things that we looked at, it was just, I mean, you really, really would have limited yourself if you would have had a really big SPAC. I think Aikman SPAC liquidated, a couple of social capital SPACs liquidated. It's just because at that size, I mean, and that especially the amount that's in the sponsor promote, the economics are poor. And the SPAC, the whole SPAC business model is really not made for high interest rate environment like we have now. And that's why you're seeing very, very few SPAC IPOs. You know, when we went public and I tell our investors our money was costing 0.9, now it's costing you 5. And when you, so you're, it's a lot easier to 10X, go from 0.9 to and 10X that, you have to 10X cost of 5%, that's a lot. That's a 50% return. And it's very, very difficult. It's not impossible, but it's difficult to justify in this environment that you're going to go out there and get a 50% return. The investors are likely going to feel like they're at risk. As far as educating ourselves and educating all of your listeners, I mean, I would just say that we have tried to get other people in, especially other African Americans, to get in the SPAC. It seems a little bit daunting for most people on the sidelines. It's really just part of the whole New York landscape, the Wall Street thing. They throw a lot of big words out there. And if you look them up, you're like, is that what that means? I remember the Hutton used to, we would be writing everything down on Zoom, just writing everything they said down. It's like, why do you guys feel the need to write everything down? So it's because we're trying to learn. We're trying to learn. So we, every time they said something we didn't understand, we'd pick up the pencil, start writing, and then look it up later. I think that's how you're going to, if you're going to do this going forward, and if you have a SPAC that's still looking for a target, first of all, you got to get to work. I mean, there's some really good middle market sell side investment banks that probably have some targets available. In a low interest rate environment, the seller, the target's going to get more money. You're going to end up paying the same, but the target's going to get more money. The bank's going to get less money because money's less expensive. In a high interest rate environment, the bank's going to get more money and the target's going to get less money. So the transactions really, from a cash flow standpoint, don't change that much. But because there's more assets being challenged from a valuation standpoint, I would think there's more opportunities, and there's a lot of PEs that need to move assets out of their portfolio. I would think that a lot of the people who are running SPACs right now probably decided not to liquidate last year because they could see that, some of these, there might be some opportunities. Some of them only have about, the trust is almost gone. There's probably about 25, 30,000 shares left, but it's worth hanging on, because you may be able to catch a target and may be able to get the listing requirements, maybe not on NASDAQ Global, but maybe on NASDAQ Capital or NYSE America, and still make your deal happen. But you saw a lot of SPACs, if I'm sure you're pretty informed on that, but a lot of SPACs that went on and extended, and some of them were cashless extensions too, and pay anything into the trust.
Yeah, that's been the market for the last few years. But, and as you said, when you're looking for something in this environment that is going to be, bankable and interesting for investors to get into once it is a public company, the one thing that still holds that upside are these battery technologies and that are going into the new wave of EV growth there. I think SPAC watchers have become more and more familiar with some of the details and the differences between the different kinds of battery technology, between solid state and lithium ion, et cetera. But could you walk us through a bit what, Solidion has and what attracted you to them specifically?
Well, really it's the materials. I mean, battery cell manufacturers before, we had looked at a battery cell manufacturer before we merged with Honeycomb. I don't think we got a good reception at Wall Street. They were all talking about how all their battery cell investments tanked and everybody lost a lot of money. So when we came to Honeycomb, primarily they were carving out their battery IP from their graphene business, which is different than graphite. Graphene is just a sheet of vinyl, I believe, with that's coated with graphite, and it's used for fast charging applications. I don't think we were interested in that, but they carved out the intellectual property for the EV battery, for one. And more remarkably, they have the technology to convert biochar, which is made from wood waste material, into synthetic graphite. And just by coincidence, as soon as we start going down the road, Lord and behold, the U.S. says that these materials by 2030 have to come from the United States. And right now, 86 to 90% of the graphite in the world comes from China. So I'm sure that's who that legislation was aimed at, number one. Number two, the U.S. only has two, to the best of my knowledge, two natural graphite mines. I believe one's in Alaska and one is in Alabama. I mean, it's very, very challenging to extract, you know, graphite from a mine that's been dormant for the amount of time that it has. You may face a lot of environmental issues. And really, it's not clean graphite. I mean, it's generally, if you pull it out of the ground, it's got ore, a lot of other metals in it. So it requires additional processing. Ours is not going to require any additional processing, except that the biomass that's disposed of will have to be converted into biochar. But once that's converted into biochar, we expect to get 89 to 92% yield out of that into graphite. So I think that's a much cleaner explanation on Wall Street. It seems to fit the narrative of go green. Right now, the synthetic graphite in the United States there's a couple of players, but they all use petroleum coke. It doesn't make a whole lot of sense to me to say, hey, we're trying to get rid of carbon and hydrocarbons emissions, and you're going to the refinery to get their residuals and then make a battery out of it. I mean, if you made enough batteries, they would have to produce even more petroleum. So what kind of sense does that make? I think our operation, our proposed operation, and our way of doing things will be cleaner. And there are honestly others in the marketplace in front of us, but they came in when inflation was looking like Mount Everest. And you know, those costs are built into their operation. The recovery of those costs have to be built in. By the time we get our plan up, which will hopefully be in the next 24 months, inflation will be much more under control than it was when those guys decided to build their structures. We'll have a lower cost of capital and a better chance of returning a fair amount of cash to our shareholders when it's all said and done.
Great. That gets straight into what I wanted to get into next, which is, you know, just could you lay out a bit, you know, what your commercialization pipeline is moving forward? You mentioned the 24-month mark in terms of getting your plant operational. What are sort of the steps there?
Well, number one, with a plant like this, one of the biggest variables, other than the known variables, the cost of land, local subsidies, government subsidies, those are known variables for everybody. But utility costs are pretty important. That's one reason why you see currently a lot of EV-related construction around the Tennessee, North Georgia, North Alabama, Kentucky area, because TVA and Southern Company are sitting there with a lot of power that they can bring to the market very, very quickly. Well, that would be a concern of ours as well. We do have a fair amount of utility requirements, and we would look to address that first. I think we are making some progress in addressing that, and it will help us make a more definitive decision in the short term. Assuming that's out of the way, the next step is to get the construction plans going and the construction in place. Graphite does sell as a commodity that does have a spot price. So we don't necessarily have to have a customer to launch it. But why we are in the process of putting the construction together, we anticipate that we will have a lot of EV manufacturing, car companies, battery manufacturers, be wanting to purchase the product. It is green. It's more carbon neutral than the other graphite. It's locally produced. It'll count 100%. So it takes away a whole bunch of issues in that regard. But I don't know that we need to have all that staple up. I will tell you that we have gotten a lot of calls since the merger was completed from a number of car makers inquiring about the graphitization project.
Great. And I guess what occupies most of your time right now, now that you're kind of on the other end of the transaction, you're starting to engage with prospective clients and working on this big project. Like, what is the biggest thing you're most engaged with, and what are you looking to expand your bandwidth on, I guess, as a company?
That's a good question. I hope I have some bandwidth left, because generally Vlad and I, you know, it's 16 hours a day for the public company. Obviously, we have a lot of the regulatory things we have to do. With me, it's just going over, you know, strategic planning and mostly what I would call shareholder engagement or investor relations, because it's, you know, these plants aren't cheap. So I've got to keep people in the loop, tell them what we need and how we need to get it. That's a huge amount of our time. Also, a lot of our sponsor promote shareholders or individuals. And then, like I said, just really planning, plotting, strategizing, trying to see what we can do in the near term to drive up the shareholder value, and what we're going to do in the long term, how much it's going to cost, where the resources are coming from. You look at, you know, you look at this whole place, it's all covered with paper. And even the door is covered with paper. So we do a lot of visualization of everything. And it may not work for some people, but I think it's working for us at this particular time. But, you know, there's no sitting down. We rang the NASDAQ bell last Friday, and I had to give a speech, and I was trying to figure out what to say. And I was like, you know, I certainly appreciate it, and I'm really spiritual, but I appreciate all these blessings, but all we've done is gotten to the stadium. We haven't put on any uniforms, haven't gotten the first down, haven't even kicked a field goal. It's not even halftime yet. So now that the celebration is about to conclude, it's time to get to work and to bring this company to where it is, to where I think it's going to go. Requires a lot of work and a lot of heavy lifting. And I don't see a way for somebody that's just, you know, a 9-to-5er, how you're going to get it done. It does require a lot of time.
Yeah, certainly. And just going back to the transaction a little bit, you know, I think any SPAC going through this market right now, you know, you have to deal with different options in terms of securing some committed capital, you know, going into close. Looks like you guys were able to add both a forward purchase agreement and some non-redemption agreements, which, you know, meant that it was going to be press capital that was going to carry over. We know that the pipe market has been incredibly tight for the last couple of years. Just sort of what were some of the options you were weighing there? What did you feel like was the best strategy as you sort of made those decisions?
Well, I think any of us would have preferred to have pipe. I mean, when we first got into the whole SPAC thing, I mean, pipe was the way to go. But it's just really remarkably, as soon as we listed it, as you mentioned before, it dried up. The pipes dried up. Some of those pipe investors, I mean, Wall Street, there's an old saying I think I heard on a Perry Mason episode, and you know, nobody likes averages that don't average. So they didn't like the fact that on average, they were losing on these pipe deals, and the pipe dried up. As a SPAC, you're very, very, very limited on what you can do unless you have the target. The target is a well-heeled, big, backed by some financial fund or institution where they can buy, they promise to buy some of the shares of the new company at a huge discount and lock them up. If you don't have that, you're probably going to be looking at a forward share purchase agreement, a backstop agreement, or a non-redemption agreement. The issue with, you have to be careful with forward share purchase agreements, or forward purchase agreements don't count towards the minimum float requirements for NASDAQ anymore. So they're not something you can put in to the deal at the beginning or at closing and expect to check the NASDAQ listing requirements when it's all said and done. It's something that you may be able to use post-closing. So the use of those forward purchase agreements has really, really shrunk down. And what you really see is what they call equity lines of credit. I think one's called a share equity purchase agreement, committed equity facility. Now, everybody's got their own name for it, but it's the same thing. It's something that's registered, instruments that's registered after closing, and the counterparty will sell the stock into the market when you pick up the phone. Obviously, they can't sell it all at the same time. I think there's some VWAP guardrails in there somewhere. So you can't, you know, if you're a low float, low stock value stock, you may not be able to use it at all. But if you're turning, your stock is turning over and your price is moving, at least acceptable to the term sheet, you could draw down some money on that as well.
Right, and now that you've gotten past closing, how have the options, I guess, for financing changed? I mean, are there things you're still looking at in terms of, you know, bringing in some more financing to the company now that you have, you know, public share capital to work with on that?
Well, yeah, I mean, I think that's probably most of my job is to make sure that we're capitalized. I'm not sure that anything has really changed or I'm surprised by anything. I think that, you know, the challenge is that because we got a carve out and you don't want to, you know, sit around and just throw more shares into the market and dilute everybody. So you want to try to investigate to the best that you can non-dilutive financing solutions and use dilutive ones as a last resort. And that can be challenging. I was surprised how little it got talked about that in our first news release, that we were the first African-American de-SPAC. We weren't the first SPAC. I know there was one before us that ended up liquidating, and they got a lot of publicity by being the first SPAC. But when they liquidated, I guess they forgot about us. And that's not our calling card anyway. But I thought that the fact that we used 80% of our investors were African-American, Latino. I just got off the phone with a couple of them in South America right before I got on this call. It seems to me that if you're going to talk about this whole DEI stuff, and some of it's just, you know, self-suiting conversation, I'm not even sure that some of the quote-unquote advocates for actually want it to be successful. I thought that we were a great story of diversity that happened as more of a coincidence. I mean, to us, we were a first-class SPAC organization. Now we're a first-class DSPAC battery materials company who happens, not because who happens to be been founded by African-American and Latino sponsors. So I felt like that got under-discussed.
And one other thing we've seen a lot of SPACs dealing with, you know, sooner than had been typical in the past, is trying to address their warrant overhang, just because a lot of warrants are trading very low. It's, you know, cheaper than it has been in the past to, you know, offer an exchange and buy them out. But we've also, interestingly, actually just a few weeks ago, we spoke with a company who decided to go completely the other direction, just focus on share price and try to just, you know, either wait out the warrants and the warrant holders, or just live with the, you know, if there's a perception that their share price should be discounted because of it, just live with it. I don't know. I'm curious what your thoughts are on, you know, what the options for dealing with warrants are.
I would say that ours is a little bit, all warrants did not meet the, and this is public knowledge, all warrants did not meet the listing requirements for NASDAQ Global. So they'll probably, if I had to guess, have to be traded on the OTC. But I'd like them to be on some kind of exchange just so people can see them. And they don't feel like, okay, the guys just took those warrants and stuffed them in the round, you know, in the round paper file there, and never to be seen from or heard from again. But it's, I think the overhang challenge that you can't complain about if you're the CEO or the surviving entity. You can't complain about the warrant overhang. It's, you know, people that join the army can't complain about the haircuts because that comes with the territory. You know, you want long hair, I advise you not to join. We can't complain about the warrant overhang or anything else. And I'm not the kind of person that thinks like, boy, I wish we didn't have to. There's a whole bunch of things in life I wish we didn't have to deal with. But we are what we are. We're here where we are. And let's deal with it. The warrants You know, one way to make people really happy about the war situation is to perform. That we can control. And we can't control the overhang or the listing requirements when it comes to warrants from NASDAQ.
Totally. And, you know, just looking forward, you know, given, you know, with some of these conversations you're having with prospective clients, I imagine there's been at least a few inquiries from directions or potential applications that, you know, maybe you hadn't considered even before. So, I mean, what are some of the kind of the exciting things that you're able to do with this intellectual property that, you know, maybe people haven't even thought of yet?
Well, I've heard, and I am on, I defer a lot of the technical questions to a leadership team who are what I would call full-blown experts, Esquire, everything else when it comes to battery technology and materials. I have heard and gotten inquiries about the graphite being used as an insulator, as a filler for certain materials. I don't think we've really explored as a society what uses there are for graphite, especially synthetic graphite. You know, everybody looks at the battery. When you do look at that, I mean, if you're setting up a plant, I view a graphitization plant like a refinery. I used to work for an oil company, so the refinery would make gasoline some and sell some on contract and sell some on the spot market. People on the spot market would be turning to distributors or resellers. I think that's what you're going to see with the graphite too, is that there will be a robust direct to the customer relationship between Solidian and someone who really feels there's value in our product. There'll be a robust connection between Solidian and the spot market, people who just need it, you know, just need a couple tons here or there and don't want to be under long-term contract. I see that's available. And I also see export and distribution channels that'll probably be open for people who say, hey, you know, they may be selling to potential customers of ours already. And instead of us going in there butchering each other, we'll just sell to them and take our money. We're not greedy people. We'll take our money right off the top and let them handle customer fulfillment. So I think that all three of those things are probably open and available to Solidian once this facility is in place.